Live on air. Presented by Ger Sweeney.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company for another edition of the Irish programme live on ERA here on Talk Radio Europe. I do hope you've had a nice week, and for the next 50 minutes or thereabouts, we're going to be relaxing and telling you about things happening in Ireland or happening in and around Spain that would be of interest to the Irish community. Coming up this evening, I'm going to be focusing a lot on the Irish artist George Campbell, otherwise known in Spain as Jorge Campbell. I'm going to be talking to Carlos Perez Torres, who was a friend of George Campbell's, and I will be talking as well to a lady by the name of Breda Smith, and Breda runs an art gallery in Kilcock in County Kildare, and there's a link between all of those and George Campbell. That's coming up later on the programme. Peter O'Dwyer, the senior business reporter with the Times Ireland edition, will be talking to us about what was a relatively busy week in Brexit and Ireland. And Ireland is gripped with hurling fever at the minute, because the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Final takes place in Croke Park in Dublin between Limerick and Galway next Sunday. And I'll be talking to Jerome O'Connell from the Limerick Leader about the build-up in Limerick to that. We have some music in there as well. I'll be telling you about some birthdays, some historical facts, and as I said, other bits and pieces in there too. Now, if you'd like to contact the programme at any stage, I would love to hear from you. The email address is the best way to contact us, ger, at talkradioeurope.com. We're going to start with our birthdays. We've got five famous Irish birthdays this week to tell you about. Tomorrow, the 14th of August, we say a very happy birthday to Dermot Desmond. Businessman, was born in Macroom in County Cork in 1950, so happy 68th birthday to him. And the golfer, Darren Clark, was born 50 years ago on the 14th of August 1968 in Dungannon in Northern Ireland. On Friday, we mark the anniversary of the birth of Maureen O'Hara, who was born in Dublin in 1920. And we hop back to Wednesday of this week, the 15th of August. Jack Lynch, former Taoiseach, was born in Cork in 1917. And Mikey Graham, one of the members of Boyzone, was born in Dublin in 1972. Mikey celebrates his 46th birthday on Wednesday, and for our first piece of music, let's take it from Boyzone and say happy birthday to Mikey Graham. You're listening to The Irish Programme on Talk Radio Europe, live on ERA. Good evening and welcome. Stay or go home, 'cause the
and be loved.
Zone, just to celebrate the fact that Mikey Graham will be 46 years old on Wednesday of this week. That's a song called Love Me For A Reason. Going to take a very quick break, come back to me just after that, and we'll talk to Jerome O'Connell about Limerick and Galway and the All-Ireland Final.
Live on Éire, presented by Ger Sweeney. Live on Éire, presented by Ger Sweeney.
As we approach next weekend, there is great excitement right across Ireland because the All-Ireland Hurling Final is going to be happening. Now, it's a little bit earlier this year. We'll talk about that in just a second. But there are two counties in particular that are terribly excited about it. They are the two counties that are taking part. Galway, who are the All-Ireland title holders, and Limerick, who haven't won it since 1973. We're joined on the phone right now by Limerick leaders GAA correspondent Jerome O'Connell. Jerome, good evening and thank you for taking our call this evening.
Good evening, Ger.
I decided, number one, because we had worked together many years ago and you understand that I know absolutely nothing about sport, that I talk to you, but also because you're based in Limerick and Limerick hasn't won the All-Ireland Hurling Final since we beat Kilkenny back in 1973. The place must be electric.
I know, you had to come straight in and mention the 45 years of hurt and heartbreak, Ger, but it's too long from a Limerick point of view, and there's been a lot of heartbreak along those years. Lost the final the following year in 74, we lost one in 80, we lost two in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's actually 11 years since Limerick have even been in the final. As you say, big excitement in both counties, but particularly in Limerick. You know, Galway had their year last year, but I suppose Limerick are the new kids on the block.
Yeah.
You know, I was just talking to one businessman alone last week, and he told me he was importing 20,000 Limerick flags of different sizes and shapes.
Wow.
Just to for the demand that was out there. You know, it's pretty huge, yeah.
What's the population of the county of Limerick, do you know?
Limerick would be roughly 190,000.
Okay.
Croke Park will hold 82,000. I think it's fair to say Limerick will probably slightly outnumber Galway on the day. But, you know, I know that in Limerick they're erecting big screens for the staging of the final as well. And in 24 hours, they sold out over 6,500 tickets for that event. Now, it's a free event, but you do need a ticket, and yeah, there's 6,500 gone in 24 hours.
Limerick has been transformed over the last decade, and there is a great buzz. And if this must be giving Limerick people a huge lift as well, is it?
It does. You know, sport is great in that regard. You know, yes, there's heartbreak, but you know, sport brings such optimism and such happiness to people, you know, across all walks of life. It's the one thing it brings everyone together in the one love of a sport, and it really does. You know, thankfully we've had great weather this summer. The fact that the Limerick hurlers have been going so well, it really gives everyone across Limerick a great buzz. And you know, they're underdogs, and you know, it's always nice to see underdogs do well as well. And yeah, I suppose, you know, gives us all a bit of a lift that, you know, if they can do this, you know, why can't I do whatever I'm turning my hands to?
At the introduction, I mentioned that it's a little earlier than it normally would be, because it would normally be the first Sunday in, is it the first or second Sunday in September it used to be?
Yeah, and it's a bit strange. It feels a bit different.
Yeah.
The Limerick hurling manager was actually asked about that just the other night when Limerick were doing their media interviews ahead of the All-Ireland final, and he said, you know, was played on Christmas Day, you know, you wouldn't mind as long as Limerick win it, but yeah, it does feel different, you know. It shouldn't be quite this early because of the visit of the Pope to Ireland the weekend after next, isn't it?
Yes.
The hurling final has come forward a little bit extra, but yeah, that's the plan going forward, as they say, to hold it in late August for the years ahead.
Now, just to explain for people that don't know how the All-Ireland series works, the way it used to work was that you would have the teams within the province, so the Munster teams would play each other, and if you were beaten, you were out. That's it. You might get one game in the season until as such time as you had one team was the champion in that particular province, and then the four province champions would play each other in the semi-final, and then the two winners would play in the final. It was a very simple process. I suppose rather unfair in so many ways, because lads were training for 6 months and then they get one game and it was all over. Now, this year it was done slightly differently. Can you talk us through the structure this year, please, Jerome?
Essentially, there was two groups, you know, a Leinster Championship and a Munster Championship. Every team was guaranteed four group games, as we called them from the outset, spread over 6 weeks. That meant you had five teams in each group, and you had three of those five teams then to progress from that initial series onto the All-Ireland stage. And it really has brought a bit of a spark to the championship, and I think it has heightened the interest as well, because there were so many great games earlier in the year, in the end of May and throughout June, that, you know, we didn't really have to wait to the All-Ireland semi-final or the All-Ireland final this year for hurling to be the topic of conversation.
No.
It really was the Monday morning topic of conversation throughout June and all of July.
I don't mean to be hogging this for any Galway person that might be listening. This is not all about Limerick. I want to talk about the two teams, if we can, in a very non-technical way. And Galway being the title holders at the minute, they were very lucky to get through the two semi-finals that they had with Clare, beating them by a point a couple of weeks ago. What does the manager, let's say Michael Donoghue in Galway, what does he have to do with his team, do you think, Jerome, in order to get them over the line? Has he a lot of work to do?
He's got a lot of work to do, but the big thing from a Galway point of view is, you know, and you mentioned the Clare game, and they had a replay in the Leinster finally with Kilkenny.
That's
so it took them two games to get over Kilkenny. They then had a replay with Clare, and it took them two games to get over Clare. But the key thing is they've won both games, and they've got through both games, and there's an experience that comes with being champions that, you know, maybe the second time round you don't quite have to hit the 100% performance that you probably needed the first year.
Right.
That you can be a little bit below par, and just the sheer experience of being here before and having done it before can get carry you over the line. And I think that was very much the case against Clare, that, you know, for everything that Clare threw at them, and Clare would have been the underdogs, Galway just managed to fall over that winning line. That's a big thing they've had in their back pocket. Limerick pretty much had to be at 100% in their semi-final to beat Cork.
Mm.
Limerick will have to repeat that, whereas Galway are probably thinking, you know, we've got a bit more in the tank here if we can just find it. I think the fact that they were in the final last year, they've been through all of that, there's a lot of pomp and a lot of ceremony. The teams are pretty much out in the field for 40 minutes before the actual game commences.
Right.
And that's a long time between these got a parade, anthem, they're introduced to the President of Ireland. Limerick's team would be average age 22, 23. These guys haven't been through this before. That's a big experience that Galway will look to. Now, Galway have been brilliant for probably the opening 20 minutes of their last four games. Absolutely outstanding. Looked like the All-Ireland champions of last year. But they just seem to dip for maybe 15, 20 minutes after that. They've been quite poor before and after halftime in the last of their games. So I'm sure, you know, you know, Dunne and his management team are probably stressing to him, look, you know, if you can go out there and play for 70 minutes, you can retain this All-Ireland. It's probably what they're going to need, because Limerick have shown themselves to be pretty steady over the 70 minutes. The carrot or the target for Galway is to repeat a back-to-back All-Ireland, just like they did back in 1987 and 1988. And they want to emulate that team, and a good team wins an All-Ireland. It's a great team that wins the second All-Ireland.
Let's talk about Limerick for a second. And you said, well, thanks very much for doing the introduction and reminding us about the 45-year gap. And I go back to 1995 when Clare won their first All-Ireland title for the first time in 81 years. And
yeah.
Anthony Daly and James O'Connor and all those lads have been asked over and over again, how much was that in your mind going out on the day? How much will it be in the minds of the Limerick players that, you know, they have a chance to do something that great teams down through the years since 1973 haven't done? Will there be extra pressure on them for that?
It doesn't appear so. All media will talk of it, and, you know, it has been mentioned by supporters, and it's a massive subplot to the whole thing. Look, they're very young. They're 22, they're 23. An awful lot of them won an under 21 All-Ireland last year. Not to be disrespectful to their generation, but they're a generation that live in the now. They live in the instant. They're not bothered about 45 years ago. they're actually not. They're not bothered about last weekend. That's the generation that they grew up in.
Okay.
They're not bogged down in the past, and it doesn't appear to be media talk coming from the camp. This genuinely appears to be the way these players are. You know, I remember talking to one of them before the semi-final, and I was just saying, like, that most of you haven't been in Croke Park before to play there. And he was one of the older guys, and he just said to me, he said, Jerome, most of the guys in this panel don't even know when Limerick were last in Croke Park, never mind when they were there themselves. You know,
right.
It's the generation that they're in. So I don't think it's going to affect the players, but it's certainly huge for the supporters and for the media as well, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
And I was going through the population statistics in Limerick, and there's more than half of the current population of Limerick that never saw Limerick win an All-Ireland hurling title.
That's incredible.
And I'm one of those myself, and I've seen them lose 3-4 All-Irelands in my time.
Right.
So it's a huge thing for supporters. I genuinely don't think it's weighing on the players, but there will be enough expectation on the players you know, coming from their own camp, because the fact that Limerick only been there once in the last 11 years, these opportunities don't come around too often. So you've got to grasp it when you can.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you to call it for me. Galway or Limerick?
You see, there's a heart and there's a head here.
But yeah.
I can guarantee you that the heart is saying Limerick. And I genuinely think that the head is also telling me Limerick. Now, I'm not quite sure if the heart is getting a bit of a nudge in there.
Okay.
But Limerick have played 17 games this year. I've seen all 17 games. They were poor in one game. Now, that was a championship game against Clare, which they lost. But I'm pretty sure that if they can reproduce the performance of most of the other 17 games, that they can beat this Galway team. They're going to need a bit of luck along the way. But I think Limerick have a big, big chance of winning this All-Ireland.
All right. Now, I have absolutely no hope of talking to anybody for next week's programme. So there's no point in saying that we will do it, because it'll be a Monday evening and the losers won't want to talk to anybody and the winners will be too busy and doing their celebrations. So I suppose we just have to keep the fingers crossed and hope for the best. It all throws in at 3:30 Irish time, 4:30 in Spain next Sunday. And I suppose it's a question of wishing the Galway and the Limerick players the very best of luck. And Jerome, by the way, when you mentioned that you have never seen Limerick win an All-Ireland, I did, and I got a half day from school because of it. back in 1973, the team came to the school and they brought the cup with them, and we got a half day and no homework.
Well, I can guarantee you, if Limerick do win it, that there'd be no one working in Limerick for at least half the week, never mind a half day. So.
Well, listen, I do appreciate you, listeners. Jerome is actually on holidays at the moment before he winds up, so thank you for taking time out before you head back to work tomorrow, and we wish you well and hope it's a fabulous day for you and a great result as well, Jerome.
Great, thanks, sir.
Jerome O'Connell is the GAA correspondent with the Limerick Leader. Absolutely beautiful. Harry's Game, and that comes from Celtic Women. And lovely, taking us back a couple of years. Now, talking about going back a couple of years, let's have a look at some of the events that happened down through the years in Ireland. It was on this date, the 13th of August in 1947, that the Health Act extended the powers of county councils and provided maternity care in Ireland. In 1974, Kate O'Brien, the Irish writer, died. And we'll be doing a lot more about Kate O'Brien in the coming weeks on the programme. That's a promise. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the 14th of August, down through the years in history, it was in 1850 that the Irish Franchise Act was enacted and had the effect of increasing the electorate from 45,000 to 164,000. 1903 on that day. The Land Purchase Act, the Windham Act, it was also known as, was enacted and allowed for entire estates to be purchased by the occupying tenantry, subsidised by the state. In 1969, the first deployment of British troops in Northern Ireland. And in 1992, in sport, boxer Michael Carruth won an Olympic gold medal in Barcelona. On Wednesday, the 15th of August in 1649, Oliver Cromwell arrived in Ireland as Commander-in-Chief and Lord Lieutenant, with an army of 20,000, a huge artillery train and a large navy. It was in 1803 that Edmund Rice opened a school for poor boys in Waterford, a precursor of the schools run by the Christian Brothers. And in 1998, a massive bomb exploded in Omagh in the centre of the town. 29 people were killed and hundreds injured. On Thursday, the 16th of August, we mark the anniversary of the first Dáil in 1921 being dissolved, and the second Dáil convening. 1982 on that day, Malcolm MacArthur, who was wanted for murder of a nurse named Bridie Gargan, was found in the apartment or the flat of the Attorney General Patrick Connolly. Mr Connolly resigned on this date as well. Friday, the 17th of August, is the last day that we have something for you from the year 2000. On the 17th of August, the last RUC passing out parade took place in Belfast before the force's controversial name change to the Police Service of Northern Ireland. And the following year, in 2001, General Semiconductor announced that its plant in Macroom in County Cork was going to close. 670 jobs were lost as a result of that. Just some of the things happening in Irish history down through the years in this coming week. I'm going to take a very quick break, and coming up just after that, Peter O'Dwyer will be talking to us about Ireland and Brexit.
Live on ERA, presented by Ger Sweeney. Live on ERA, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Brexit and Ireland is a topic that we visit every week on Live on ERA, and today is no exception. Peter O'Dwyer is the Senior Business Reporter with the Times Ireland Edition, and he joins us on the phone now. Peter, good evening and thank you for joining us.
No problem, Ger.
The peace process is something that is hugely important and has been since 1998. I suppose the UK government and the Irish government would refer to it quite a lot. However, we understand from reports during the week that the UK negotiators have asked Ireland to kind of tone down the references to the peace process. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. It was a week where there wasn't too many public appearances by any of the main characters, but as always, behind the scenes, stuff was going on. And this week, we got sight of some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes a couple of months ago, seemingly kind of before the Chequers meeting that Theresa May had with her cabinet. And as you say, it was essentially the British government officials asking the Irish counterparts to ease off on the emphasis that was being put on the peace process in the context of Brexit. Now, I think it is probably important to state that, as you say, the Good Friday Agreement was, you know, such a landmark thing. It's so important to Ireland, Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And both governments are co-guarantors, and explicitly they've always, you know, backed that completely. So it is important to state that, you know, the UK is clearly committed to it. But it was just very interesting that it seemed to come from Theresa May feeling that her credentials in that area were being somewhat overlooked. And the officials in the UK were of the opinion that it was coming across that the peace process was only important to Dublin, to nationalists, to Ireland, whereas unionists, Theresa May, the Conservatives, the DUP, who obviously are keeping Theresa May in power, yeah, all felt equally as strongly about it, but that they felt that message was getting lost. So They asked for it to be toned down, and that request was essentially rejected by the Irish government because they felt that it should be front and centre to everything that's going on in Brexit negotiations.
A very interesting request. Now, there are a couple of new ideas being floated at the minute as well, and Jersey has a particular relationship with the EU, and some new proposal, I think they're calling it the Jersey model, proposed that the Irish border would be looked upon in the same way. Can you talk us through that?
This is reports that we had in the Times during the week where our guys in Brussels were reporting that member states would very seriously consider adopting the Jersey model if it were to be put on the table by Theresa May and the UK government, which of course it hasn't been yet. The Jersey model is, as the name suggests, the model that currently operates between Jersey and the EU and the other Crown Dependency Islands and the EU. What it would allow is for the UK to stay within the single market for goods while also ending the free movement of people. These are the four freedoms that the EU all along has said you can't separate them, they're indivisible. The idea here is that they would actually be divisible, that you could have, to a certain extent, your cake and eat it as the UK.
Right.
Now, the idea is that while Michel Barnier is still sticking to that line that you can't pick and choose, you can't cherry pick, you can't have your cake and eat it, that I suppose a level of pragmatism maybe is creeping in amongst the leaders of the individual countries as opposed to the Commission itself, and that they would be willing to consider this even if at the moment Barnier and the Commission's officials aren't publicly stating that. So it would seem like a relatively attractive prospect for the UK. It would, of course, have knock-on impacts for them, though, and they wouldn't get everything, I suppose, that they want, in that they would be required to, in all likelihood, adopt a whole host of EU environmental protections, social protections. And if that were the case, when they went to strike free trade deals with other nations across the world, they'd be seriously hampered in that regard, because you wouldn't be able to include manufactured goods in those deals, nor would you be able to include agricultural produce.
Right.
So it's certainly not exactly what Brexiteers would like, but it does seem like it's a possible ray of light that if Theresa May were to explore it, it seems like some EU member states would be willing to discuss it at least.
And has there been any reaction from Dublin?
No, very little. Everybody's on their holidays at the moment, it seems. Right. So there's been a tumbleweed so far, okay. But it's one of those that it's likely to be discussed next month, when the leaders are due to meet in Strasbourg. So if that's going to be on the agenda, sure as day, in the lead up to it, a couple of weeks beforehand, we'll hear bits and pieces from them in advance of that.
And while we know that things, we're still uncertain as to what is going to happen in every aspect of Brexit, but I saw on Saturday that the Irish Times was reporting that post-Brexit duty-free was set to hit the tax take. But then there was also conversations, I've heard people over the weekend talking about the fact that if there is a border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, that you could have duty-free and tax-free shops set up along the border area and stuff like that. Is that kind of just guesswork? Was it just a flyer?
I don't think it's a million miles off. It's very difficult. It's probably an informed guess would okay. probably be the best way of going about it. But it's a potential real-world impact. You know, all of this can, I suppose, be quite distant from people's everyday lives. So it's a potential real-world impact that we could see. Just like this week, there was a real-world impact in that sterling slid quite significantly by about its biggest amount in a year. So
right.
any of your listeners who were leaving the UK and going to Spain for a couple of days, or if they were going to the States, they were getting fewer euros into their back pocket in exchange for their sterling, or fewer dollars.
Hmm.
And these are the real world impacts that we can maybe lose sight of sometimes when we're talking about the mechanics of how Brexit may or may not work. But it is having a real world impact already. And something like the duty free along the border is another potential real world impact that it could have in the not too distant future.
And just in relation to the border area, just very quickly, I know that there's not a lot of information on this one, but over the weekend, information came to light that there's a bill going through Westminster at the minute that, if passed, or when passed, they say, would allow for people to be stopped and searched at will within a mile of the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Is there any reaction to that, or any feedback from that, or is it just something that has to unravel?
Well, we've seen some responses already from the parties in the north. Claire Hanna, who's the Brexit spokesperson for the SDLP, called it an affront to the peace agreement. She said that if there was any hardening of the border, it would be an affront to the peace agreement, never mind actually stopping and searching people. So
yeah.
This is, you know, if we've had such a backlash to the prospect of a hard border as a result of Brexit, you can only imagine the type of response that there'd be to this idea of stopping people in places like Derry or Strabane in County Tyrone or wherever, and searching them. I mean, when I first heard of it, because I wasn't aware of this legislation until over the weekend as well, it was hard to believe, just in the context of the hard border discussion that we're all having. The fact that this would be working its way through Westminster seems quite incredible. And I suppose it is important to say that it's not a Brexit-related piece of legislation.
No.
It's in relation to counter-terrorism and looking to beef up the police powers in that regard.
All right. Okay, for an August, we had quite a lot happening in the past week in relation to Brexit and Ireland. Peter O'Dwyer, the senior business reporter for the Times Ireland edition, thank you again for joining us on this Monday evening on Talk Radio Europe.
Thanks, sir.
And coming up just after a very short break, we're going to be listening to Carlos Perez Torres talking to us about the Irish artist George Campbell.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney. Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
George Campbell, or Jorge Campbell, as he is known in the Malaga area, is a well-known, or was a well-known Irish painter and artist who used to split his time between living in Ireland and coming to Malaga to spend some time here over the winter periods. He died suddenly back in 1979. And I suppose, like a lot of well-known, talented individuals, he has probably become more popular since his death than he was when he was alive, although he did get a lot of credit for the work that he did. Now, I'm telling you this because I'm sitting beside a man in Malaga, and that man's name is Carlos Perez Torres, and he's going to talk to me about George Campbell, or Jorge Campbell, as a lot of people would know him. Thank you very much for talking to me and welcoming me to your home. Carlos, firstly, tell us a little bit about yourself, if you would.
Thanks to you. You're very welcome. Myself, well, I'm a school teacher, secondary school teacher, teaching Spanish and language and literature. And I'm also a writer. I publish some 4 or 5 poetry books, and my last collection of short stories are going on. I used to have a personal connection with George Campbell because my father was a painter himself, Enrique Pérez Almeida by name. He's a very well-known painter in Malaga. And he met George Campbell in London way back in 1960, and they became really close friends. So when I was a kid, a young, 8, 9, 10-year-old boy, George Campbell and his wife, Madge, used to come home, and I was too young by then, of course. But later, when I first traveled to Ireland, a country which I loved so well, they put me up in their home in Florence Terrace there in Dublin, in Ranelagh. And I have my own memories of both George and Madge. And even later after he died, well, through my father mostly, I had the good knowledge of the sense of in Malaga that George Campbell had not been properly, people here had not said goodbye to him in a proper way. So I had a chance to coordinate and, organize two parallel exhibitions which were held as a tribute to George Campbell back in 2002. That was kind of comfort for me. The cultural world in Malaga, the world of painting in Malaga, had at long last had the opportunity to honour George Campbell as he deserved. That's a very funny thing to tell you, but I really started to know George Campbell after his death. When he died, I had an opportunity to see how much in shock the local people in the world of art in Malaga were, and how much he was loved and missed. Because apart from his heights as a painter, he was a very special man. He was charismatic, he was magnetic, he had a friendship and a very high esteem and consideration. We had to somehow heal that wound. So that was a kind of opportunity to say what we hadn't said so far. I think George Campbell is the first artist ever to have his own physical location, spot named after him anywhere in the world.
Just tell me about that, because I know that there is a roundabout which is called Jorge Campbell. Tell me about how that came about.
That took place in 2006. There was some days called Irlanda in Malaga going on with concerts and around St. Patrick's Day. And one of those initiatives was that the opening of a urban space in the area of Cerrado de Calderón. And that big roundabout is named Jorge because in Malaga nobody called him George. Yeah. He was called as a local. It was very funny. In the documentary, there's another initiative, a short film, a documentary called Looking for Jorge, Seeking for George, both a bilingual film. And in one of the scenes, somebody tells an anecdote of Jorge in La Buena Sombra. La Buena Sombra was the name of a tavern, the Bohemian tavern in the 60s in Malaga, the place where people with great ideas and little money used to meet there every night. and celebrate life and arts and everything. And he was the center of the reunions I was telling you before. He was usually accompanied by some other fellow painters, Irish painters who came with him, Arthur Armstrong, Manus Walsh, Albert Meagle. Some of them are living in Malaga nowadays, and some others come to Malaga every winter. And he said, when I'm sitting at the counter in La Buena Sombra, I have the feeling that sometimes I see a local man over there, and I say, oh, maybe he's called Patrick, because the locals resembled Irish people, and in the other sense also, he himself looked like a Malaganian. So there's a strong link, not only in that, considering musical terms, for example, and the mood of the people. So he found in Spain something very inspirational for him. When he first came to Spain, I mean, George Campbell, in the summer of 1951, Gerard Dillon also came with him, another important painter, Irish painter. From that year on, he kept coming. He kept coming. He spent 5 or 6 months, half the year in Malaga. So he had, of course, his spiritual roots in Ireland and the Celtic imaginary and all that, especially in the Connemara landscapes and the western regions. But also in Andalusia, he found a lot of inspirations, and he worked on matadors and gypsies and singers and peasants. And he was also an accomplished flamenco guitar player. He was accepted at such a point, not only as a man, not only as an artist, but also as a flamenco interpreter, which is not easy, I can tell you.
And what did he bring to the cultural world, the artistic world in Malaga when he came? What did he leave people that is specifically Jorge Campbell?
When he came, he met some people, and one of the artists that George Campbell met, and he was influenced by him, was Stefan von Reid, which is a big name in Malaga. He's a German painter and sculptor. If you have strolled around the Parque del Oeste in Malaga, the West Park in Malaga, you have probably seen a huge amount of sculptures, strange figures, and snail-like humans, bird-like persons, and strange creatures, sirens, all those oxen, all those sculptures are made by Stefan. Stefan had his own surrealistic world, and he influenced George Campbell. George had been working on the linear composition, the human figure, and through Stefan, he became interested in abstraction, semi-abstraction. He started collaborating with the Grupo Picasso, which was an important artistic initiative in Malaga those days, also with Colectivo Palmo. George Campbell was invited to join them, I mean, Stefan and Robert MacDonald and Jorge Lindell, which were the members of an important group working the etchings, Taller Grabados, we'd say Grabados, etchings, it's okay, etchings, El Pesebre, that was the name. And Jorge Campbell was occasionally invited to join them. So he grew interested in Cubism, and through Cubism he worked on abstraction. He was constantly working, you know, he couldn't be standing still. That must be a dynamo on George Campbell working, you know. He was a very active man, and always, as I tell you, striving to improve and experiment new ways of art. As I told you, I was a young boy when George Campbell was a friend at home. But I can see hundreds of little caricatures, drawings and catalogues, and dedication on these catalogues to my dad and mom. All the watercolours hanging on my mom's house now, because my father died some years ago. And I can see how strong his impact and his influence was. And my father learned a lot from George Campbell, new techniques. I mean, oil, apart from oil paintings, crayon and ink, mixed media compositions, etchings, new ways to represent life, in a sense.
How do you think George Campbell would feel about having the roundabout here in Malaga named after him? Do you think he'd be proud?
I think he would be proud, yes. That place is near Pedregalejo. Pedregalejo was the old fishermen's houses, and not a very rich area at the time. It has changed, as I told you lately. That was the usual place, Pedregalejo, where George Campbell would hire would rent the apartments to live those 5 or 6 months every year. I think the town council had that in mind when they decided to place the urban space in memory of George Campbell right there, because it was on the area he usually walked, no? I think he would be proud, yes.
Tell me about your visits to Ireland. You mentioned there that the first time that you went to Ireland was in 1979 and you met George and you stayed with him and his wife. So you've been back, you said, 2 or 3 other times. Tell me about your opinions in Ireland. What do you like?
Well, I'm a fan. You know? Yes, I've been there 4 times, I think, now. The first time was very interesting because I went to the West mainly. I was there in the County Clare. But I went to Dublin for a whole week because I had the commission to give the regards from my father and mother to George and Margarita. Margarita was much. Local people in Malaga called Jorge, and they called Margarita. Margarita was much Campbell. And I remember walking with George Campbell in St. Stephen's Green, combining both Spanish and English in our conversation because I was trying to improve my English at the time. And I also remember having tea, talking to Madge about literature. My interest in literature was showing by then. She was showing me some short stories by Patrick Kavanagh and O'Connor while George was taking the photographs. And I also remember a big fiesta in their home with George Campbell playing the Spanish guitar and a big number of Irish and Spanish friends there in their house. That year, sadly, he died from brain hemorrhage. And then I went back 2 other times as a young man because I was interested in the Celtic world, the art, the history. You know, a funny anecdote, but I even support the Celta de Vigo, which is a football club in Spain, located in Galicia, and I'm from Malaga, nothing to do with Andalusia and Galicia, but I'm still interested in the Celtic world in every aspect. And then the most recent time I went with my wife and daughters because I wanted them to know Ireland as well.
Carlos, you did mention to me when we were speaking before the microphone was turned on, and you did say at the start that you're a writer yourself, and I know that you've written many essays about George Campbell. Can I ask you what your most recent work is in relation to essays about George Campbell, and maybe you might even give us a flavour of it?
Sure, yeah. I have written long essays on his life and work, but the most recent one, it's been on occasion of the centenary of his birth last year. This is an updated chronicle on his significance as an artist, and a multilingual magazine, TSN, T for Transatlantic, S for Studies, N for Network, Transatlantic Studies Network. That's the title of the magazine. It's published by the university, Malaga University. The department of the university in charge of this is the Aula Maria Zambrano. That's the name. That magazine will be presented on the 11th of September. So my last essay is included there. If you like, I can read the introductory paragraph. So George Campbell was a great painter, and his artistic mood was contagious to anyone who approached him, as he had a magnetic personality, a fine sense of humor, and he appreciated friendship above anything else. This essay revises the values of his career as a painter, who enjoyed recognition and admiration, and explores his connections to other artists whom he met in Malaga and kept close to him. The final part intends to explain in detail why the figure of Campbell can perfectly reflect the confluence of interests between the society and culture of Ireland and Spain, particularly Andalusia. Yeah, that's why they have, the university, Malaga University, this Aula Maria Zambrano, they have just established the prize George Campbell. The second edition is currently running now. This is to foster the collaboration between the Irish and Andalusian universities regarding any field, connecting the history, the art, economy, etc., from the recent past to nowadays. That's a prize, George Campbell.
On front of us here on your table, you have a selection of newspaper clippings and magazine articles from other people who have paid tribute to Jorge Campbell. Can you maybe give us a flavour of the type of things that people have been writing about him?
Sure. Shortly after George Campbell died, his long life friend and painter, also a member of the Royal Hibernian Academy, Arthur Armstrong, wrote some ideas. and I have selected one of those. George Campbell and Arthur Ramsay was the kind of couple. They usually went together to places and pubs. And in my notes I had written, I told you before, the words Don Quixote and Sancho, because by the thin and tall figure of Arthur Armstrong, maybe he would resemble Don Quixote in a way, and that fat, shorter figure of George would look like Sancho. But in fact, it was the other way around. The sensible one was Arthur, a very silent man. And George, on the other hand, was always trying to improve. He would fantasize sometimes. He would never stop thinking of new strategies, new ideas, always striving to improve, no? So, so to speak, he was seeking a new artistic adventure. So that's why Don Quixote and Sancho, forgive me, but I'm a teacher of Spanish literature, and it shows. So Arthur Armstrong wrote this one. He says, he thought nothing of giving a morning or afternoon to look at the work of an aspiring young artist, to give him a practical lesson in the use and handling of various media. In a few hours, he would impart information and technical knowledge that he had spent years accumulating, never regarding it as his private secret, but as something to be shared. I have selected this quotation because it shows the generosity in the, you know, in his personality. I told you before that my father learned quite a lot from George because he was enthusiastic and very, his laughter was infectious. Susan Stairs wrote a book whose title was The Irish Figurists. And in that book, there was a section regarding George Campbell. And I have selected some connecting, you know, his links with Spain. These are words by Susan Stairs. Spain was to fire the dynamic imagination of George Campbell. Its exuberance, its power, its vitality, he felt at home there. Even looked like native. Felt he had found an inspiration like no other. He explored all it had to offer in infinite studies of musicians, flamenco guitarists and dancers, gypsies, matadors, peasants. He produced some of his finest work in Spain during the months he spent there. He felt Spain had many links with Ireland, especially in terms of music, comparing traditional Spanish music with traditional Irish. Indeed, he was a fine flamenco guitarist himself and was one of the few foreigners to be accepted as a maestro by the people of Spain. One year before he died, in 1978, he received the honor of being given a knighthood, given the commander with the insignia and privileges of the Merito Civil. That was in recognition of his task of always reflect the cultures of Spain and Ireland, no? A deep love and the portrayal of the people of both countries, especially Spain.
This is a fascinating conversation, and I asked you about your painting, and because your dad was an accomplished painter. George Campbell's mother, you tell me, was an artist and a painter as well. Tell me a little bit about her.
Yeah, mother, Greta Bowen. George started painting in 1943. He knew nothing about art. He just started through practice. He was very active, as I told you. He had been born in Arklow, County Wicklow, and he attended school in Dublin, but the family soon moved north to Belfast. There he joined the group of painters, Dan O'Neill, Gerard Dillon, Markey, Colin Middleton, his brother Arthur Campbell, Arthur Armstrong, Maurice Wilkes, Oisin Kelly. These were commonly referred to as the Belfast Boys. But they were not only boys. There were really some important female, you know, women painters like Patricia Webb, Nana Reid, Gladys Maccabi. And Greta Gowen, George Campbell's mother, became a painter. She was very enthusiastic, and she became interested in the brushes and colours only after George, her son, was standing out as a painter. So at the age of 69, she began painting. And she had a style of naive painting. I would say, that's my opinion, not very accomplished as an artist, because no, her approach to the representation of reality is very plain, no perspective. But she was, as I'm telling you, very enthusiastic. And she was another engine on the family atmosphere.
We could chat for hours. I know you could certainly chat for hours about George Campbell, and I could listen to it because it's fascinating. And it's amazing how one can get to know somebody that one never knew at all just by listening to others and appreciating the passion that people have for their work and for their personality. Thank you very much for the information that you've given us. This was only to touch very briefly on George Campbell, and to make sure that we mentioned him on the programme because he was Irish and such an important figure here in Spain as well. So, Carlos Perez Torres, thank you very much for your insight into George Campbell, and I suspect we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me to take part in the live on Airy and your programme, and okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, that's a little bit of information on George Campbell, or Jorge Campbell, and the times that he spent in Malaga. Now, by sheer coincidence, there's a small little place, a beautiful place called Kilcock, and there's a lovely art gallery there called Kilcock Gallery. And there is a George Campbell link there as well. And I'm joined on the phone right now by Breda Smith from Kilcock Gallery. Breda, I know you're on holidays in Lanzarote at the moment, so thank you for taking time out to talk to us. How are you?
That's all right, Gerard. Thank you so much. And it's wonderful to talk about George because he was a great friend of mine, and he opened the gallery in 1978 in Kilcock, County Kildare. It's on the banks of the Royal Canal, a lovely little town called Kilcock after the Saint Kilcoca, or Saint Coca, which is a funny name, but anyway.
Right. How did you and George Campbell get to know each other?
I trained in the College of Art, and then I was going to open a gallery in Kilcock in 1978. So I actually built the building in 1977.
Right.
And George and Arthur Armstrong, George Walsh, Manus Walsh from Clare, and all of these, you know, in the course of my business.
Yeah.
Of, you know, involved with the art. I asked George, would he mind officially opening the gallery?
Right.
And he did that. And we have a lovely brass plaque on the street outside, with his date of birth and death, and the fact that he was the official opener of the gallery. So,
right.
And Madge was always very appreciative of the fact that that was there.
And in fairness, you were rather fortunate because he died suddenly the following year. So it was great that the link is there and that he is commemorated in Kilcock,
yes.
Isn't it?
Oh, it is, definitely. There are times when there are little exhibitions going on or something is happening in Dublin and it has connections to George, and a lot of the people that knew him are inclined to go towards those places and see his work. I mean, he was a wonderful artist.
And Breda, can I ask you, where did the ambition to put a gallery in Kilcock come from?
Well, you see, I was always interested in art. I trained in the College of Art. I went and worked in an advertising agency, so right. I had sort of leaped to art. And when I wanted to open a business of my own, the only thing I knew anything about was art.
Right.
And my father owned quite a bit of the middle of the town, and I asked him for a site and said I was going to build an art gallery. And of course, in those days, an old-fashioned father would say to me, what are you doing that? Why don't you open a shop?
Why don't you
shop,
get a real job?
Yeah. You know, salary just means they won't make money. Open a shop. But I opened the gallery then, and it's thrived ever since. We've gone through about three recessions, but we're still there.
That's fantastic. Yes. And I know you have a website, kilcockgallery.ie, isn't it?
We have kilcockartgallery.ie. And, you know, it links to an older website as well, which shows works of artists going back
Lovely.
Over the years. You know, we have various exhibitions, including the one coming up, which also has links to Spain.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, because that starts on the 8th of September. Your 40th anniversary, isn't it?
It's 40 years ago since we started, and this is going to be a celebration of that too.
Great.
And both Marie-Louise Martin and Aidan Flanagan exhibited in Spain since 1987.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, Aidan won the exhibition in Cadagres, I think is how you pronounce it,
right.
in 2015. And he had a solo show there as well. So both of the artists have links to Spain, and we hope it's going to be a very interesting exhibition for everybody.
And just to finish, Breda, did you ever exhibit any of George Campbell's pieces?
Oh, I did indeed. At the very beginning.
Yeah.
I did. In 78, 79, that sort of time.
Right.
Owned both Arthur Armstrong and George Campbell on in a group situation.
It's been lovely talking to you. We celebrate and salute the fact that you have been in business for 40 years, and I hope that the exhibition starting on the 8th of September goes really well for you, and enjoy the celebrations.
Thank you so much, Ger. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I'm afraid that is all the time that we have for you this evening. I do hope you have enjoyed the programme as much as I have enjoyed presenting it to you. I'm back with you again next week, just after the 6 o'clock news on Monday evening on Talk Radio Europe. And please don't forget, if you would like to make contact with the programme, I would love to hear from you. The email address is ger@talkradioeurope.com. Until next week, look after yourselves and each other. Thank you for your company today, and we'll chat to you next week. Bye-bye now.